In Florida, it's about half of the state is privately held agricultural lands. That includes silviculture. If you take silviculture off the table, it's about 10 million acres of agriculture in Florida. A lot of jobs, a whole bunch of economic impact. It's one of the pillars of our economy, tourism, real estate development, and agriculture. And agriculture is fundamentally more sound than those other two pillars or other two legs of the stool, if you will. You know, a lot of biological diversity, aquifer recharge, all of these other benefits that are associated with open green space and agriculture. And the bottom ones here that talk about the impact on local property taxes. For every dollar paid in property taxes, agriculture is on an average across the state. It varies from county to county. It's 29 or 30 cents in services for every dollar paid in property taxes. So it's a net revenue generator for county government to run schools and roads and all the other things that are associated. Just segueing into the water quantity side of things. These are Florida figures. They may vary. I mean, I think they're going to vary from state to state and latitude to latitude. But generally, it's true that a lot of the water that agriculture uses is returned to the system. Not always the same system from which the water is withdrawn, but it all stays in the hydrologic cycle. We've seen in Florida, and I think this is definitely true across the nation, production continue to increase, but water use staying flat, basically flat. Some increase in irrigated acres, but no increase in water use, no substantial increase in water use, which is a testament to agriculture's commitment to the conservation ethic, that we're able to produce more and more using less and less water. And I think that's true nationwide. I'll talk a little bit about some of these bottom ones, these public-private opportunities to address water resource challenges, working collaboratively with landowners, willing landowners that are willing to store water on their property. We have a program in Florida called Dispersed Water Management that is gaining momentum, where landowners are actually willing to partner with local governments. In this state, it's the water management districts. You're in South Florida Water Management District here, but they actually partner with landowners to come up with innovative ways to store water on the landscape, trying to recreate more of the natural hydrology that existed before we began to ditch and drain the land to reclaim it for agriculture. So there's lots of different tools in the toolbox to meet our water resource quantity and quality challenges. Some of the issues that I know you face nationwide, we call agriculture a self-supplier. They have to provide the infrastructure. They pay for their own wells, they pay for their own pipes, they pay for their own pumps. There's no one to pass those costs on to. So recognizing that in public policy debate is important. If we're going to develop and promote alternative water supply projects to take the demand off of traditional groundwater or surface water sources, if we're going to help landowners be more efficient and be more conservative, we have to help them with the costs associated with developing those alternative water supplies. An example, treated wastewater reuse is something that's big in Florida. We treat and reuse about 400 million gallons a day in Florida, treated wastewater from urban areas. There's an opportunity for some sectors of agriculture to tap into that as a irrigation source. Nurseries, sod, non-food commodities, or commodities where the water doesn't come in contact with the edible fruit. Citrus can use treated wastewater as an alternative to groundwater or surface water withdrawals. So you conserve, you have an alternative water supply. What they can't afford to do is pipe the reuse water out to their fields. They don't have any way to recover the cost to do that. So we are promoting cost share programs to help extend those lines so that agricultural producers have access to that, particularly in close to urban environments where most of this wastewater is generated. But that's an example of an alternative water supply that we think has merit and can continue to be available to agriculture. This third bullet here, I'm going to get into a little more detail. The population drives water demand in Florida more than anything else. I want to show you this graph. This is 2010 data, which is the most recent data for which we've got accurate numbers that have been compiled and checked. It used to be agriculture was the largest water user in Florida for years and years and years and years and years. But public supply overtook agriculture as the largest user in 2010. And those two lines will never cross again. Public supply demand is increasing at a rate of 30%. You see the over the next, by 2030, we anticipate a 20% increase in freshwater use across the state. Only 5 of that is attributable to agriculture. 30% of that growth, almost half, over half, 782 million gallons per day, the number over here, is over half of the total increase of 1.3 billion gallons. So population drives demand. What's interesting here is that while population or urban supply continues to get an increased portion of the pie, agriculture grows a little bit, but their percentage of the overall water demands actually goes down from 39% to 34%. It creates an opportunity for competition. And this is the kind of slide that I like to use to show people why. You look at those counties where the statewide average domestic supply water demand is 41% of the total amount. In those six counties or five counties, it's over 60% of the water demand in those counties is urban. And those are some of our most productive agricultural counties too. There's a lot of overlap. Those same counties where there's that huge urban percentage of water use has to have an adequate supply of fresh water to continue to contribute economically to both the local and the state and the global economy. An example of that, you saw Orange on the other one, you saw Hillsboro. These are highly productive agricultural counties juxtaposed with their water use. You're in Palm Beach County right now, right here. That's this big square block. This is Hendry County. To the west, those are the two most productive agricultural counties in the state. $1.5 billion in cash receipts just from those two counties. They also use about 40% of the total freshwater demand for the whole state is in Palm Beach and Hendry County. But remember, we return most of that water to the system once we've used it. So it's a soundbite. That's important to recognize. The highest productive agricultural counties are also the highest water use counties. But you can't discount these other counties, Suwannee, Orange, Hillsboro, Manatee, and Miami-Dade. Those counties add up to almost $2 billion in cash receipts, but they use much less water. And so, but it's a different crop matrix that's grown in those counties. Many times, entirely different production systems, entirely different irrigation systems. So there's a lot of factors at play. But we're trying to draw a picture for the lay public and the legislators out there who control the purse strings to begin to tie water use and agricultural production to an economic value. And try to tell a story about how agriculture impacts the local economy, how important agriculture is to these rural counties like Hendry and Western Palm Beach. Hendry is all rural. There's only a few, and they're not even urban. They're small towns. But Hendry, if you look at the difference, Palm Beach County, I think, is about a 50-50 split between domestic use and agricultural use. Hendry County, 80% of the water in Hendry County is used on agriculture. So when I see that, I think we're going to have a harder time making sure that we've got adequate amounts of water available in Palm Beach County, because we're fighting for half of that water with the urban growth than we are in Hendry County, where it's much more rural and there's much more portion of the pie is agricultural related. So it helps us kind of prioritize and identify where the competition spots are going to be over that long period of time between 2010 and 2030. How do we know what agriculture is going to look like 20 years from now? We don't know what it's going to look like in Florida 5 years from now, let alone 20 years from now, but that's kind of the challenge that we're facing. And those 10 counties that you see all in South Florida utilize 60%, 68%, almost 70% of the water statewide is used in those 10 counties. Why? Great climate. Great soils, essentially a year-round growing season, a lot of really productive land and smart growers who know how to adapt and hit markets. But that's a picture that just doesn't get painted very often. So our water demand and our need to make sure we're protecting future amounts of water for agriculture, we can't lose sight of those kinds of data sets that tell us where in the state that most productive land is and the combination of where the water use is the highest. This is a slide that I show a lot in presentations because it helps get people in perspective of just how little total water we're talking about. You think about all the water on the planet, only 2.8% of it, of all the water on the planet, only 2.8% is fresh, and less than 1% of that is in rivers, streams, aquifers. It's available to us to use. So we're allocating and balancing between the natural system, urban population needs, and agriculture's needs. We're balancing with less than 1% of the total water that's on the planet. And those are percentages that, you know, have developed over eons. We're not likely to change that very much. So we're always going to be kind of in a delicate balance of how we manage these resources and make sure there's enough for Mother Nature and all of our man's uses and man's needs out there as well. I mentioned alternative water supply funding. I think that's going to be one of the biggest obstacles we face long term, is how do we identify adequate resources to develop alternative water supplies for not only agriculture, but also the urban landscape. We need to be cognizant of that. We use a lot of water, and we use a lot of water sometimes seasonally, and geographically it's diverse, and when the demand for water occurs, the highest demand for water occurs. Sometimes we use that water at a rate faster than Mother Nature can supply it. That creates challenges for us. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I want to segue, though, a little bit into water quality and talk a little bit about our best practices, our best management practices programs that have been developed over the last 15 or so years here in Florida, aggressively developed over the last 15 years. There's a number of laws that have occurred over time. Watershed Restoration Act was in 1999, Northern Everglades in 2000. Nitrogen control dates clear back to the mid-90s. But all of them promote water resource protection, best management practices, which we've developed for all sectors of the ag industry, and we've adopted them into rule. And we've got landowners participating in both forestry and general agriculture. And when you look at the map, you now know why the water demand is in South Florida. And you can see how South Florida dominates the landscape of agricultural lands enrolled in our programs. They're by different views, citrus, cow-calf, you know, mixed nut, nursery, row crops. They're all on here. At 4.16 million acres, oops. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. I'm giving it away. This number here includes, there's about 1.8 million acres of agriculture in Florida out of that 10 million acres that I talked about. Only about 1.8 is irrigated, 20%. A little over 20%. We've got 95% of it enrolled in these BMP programs. So the most intensively managed agricultural lands, where the fertilizer is mostly applied, where the water is applied, are all engaged with us in these best management practices programs that are aimed at resource protection and conservation. Nutrient management, irrigation management, you guys know the drill. This is the one group I don't need to explain what a BMP is. But I do want to show you a little bit about what the rest of the state looks like and the kinds of things that we're working on. So all day, you're going to be south of the lake, mostly south of the lake, on these mucklands that, if nothing else impresses you, it ought to impress you how incredibly flat the landscape is. There isn't a hill within 30 miles of here to speak of. That's not just limited to south of the lake. Let's go north of the lake. This is what the landscape looks like. I'm going to go past that. This is what the landscape looks like north of the lake. It's just as flat. It's very low intensity land use on the grand scale. It's not manipulated. You're in one of the most highly engineered and manipulated water managed systems on the planet, where you are now, south of the lake. It's the exact opposite north of the lake. It's all mostly grazing land, unimproved pasture land, but it's huge. It's 3 million acres. It's 10% of the state is the watershed that drains into Lake Okeechobee. The issues that we face north of the lake are very different than the issues we face south of the lake. This land isn't irrigated. It's not fertilized to any extent. The issue is stormwater management. How do we manage 55 inches of rainfall that falls on that landscape and all ends up in Lake Okeechobee? This land is passively managed. It's got very low concentration of phosphorus or nitrogen, but a huge volume of water. So the load going into the lake, the nutrient load going into the lake, is enormous. And that's a huge challenge for us to deal with. What do we do? Well, these are examples. This is a great example of a wetland buffer in an improved pasture setting with cross-fencing and ditching so the cattle can be rotationally grazed and maintain the health of the landscape. But it's a great example. But that's what the landscape north of the lake looks like. So what we control, what we deal with north of the lake, is all, like I said, stormwater management. We take these uncontrolled water control features or water conveyance features and convert them to riser structures with boards so we can stack water behind that and buffer those flows. So that huge influx of water can be buffered over time. We can store it. It's the biggest load. 90% of the load to Lake Okeechobee is associated with 10% of the rainfall events. So it's these large pulses that end up being the challenge. And with water control structures like these, we put in over 800 of them in the last 10 years north of Lake Okeechobee to help landowners stage that water across their landscape to buffer those flows going into the lake. And we create this kind of environment behind those. If we can store this water, we can benefit not only the grower, as his pasture lands adjacent to this get better, they're higher quality, they've got access to more water over the course of the year as it spreads out and fills the soil pore space with the water from these features. Wildlife habitat, they get to bleed it down over time, they can use some of it as an alternative water supply if they have irrigation needs. So there's a lot of benefit to this kind of feature, and we do this a lot. We think we've generated somewhere in the 40,000 to 60,000 acre feet of water stored behind these kinds of structures across the landscape north of the lake. Local recharge, like I said, it's good for everybody, and it's a popular item. Other kinds of things that you may not be familiar with are variable rate fertilizer spreaders. I'm sure you guys have them. These are big in the citrus industry. Got about 500,000 acres of citrus in Florida. These barrels on the front of this are electronic eyes that actually calculate the tree canopy as the spreader is going down between the rows and adjust the fertilizer coming out the back associated with the canopy volume. And if there's a gap in the trees where you get an older tree, you got to push it, or you push shovel trees, there's a gap, it shuts it off. So we're doing a much better job of the physical application of the nutrients in the citrus industry with tools like this. And there's other similar technologies for other agricultural uses. Monitoring wells for seepage irrigation, weather stations, soil moisture probes. You guys use these probably all the time in wherever you are, Iowa or Wisconsin or wherever. They all have a role to play. We're trying to really promote real-time data into the hands of users. We've developed these apps where landowners can see what their weather station data on their smartphone or on their computer. We're putting on irrigation controllers on irrigation systems so that they can control their irrigation system remotely based on real-time weather and soil moisture data, giving them the tools to try to continue to manage an already efficient irrigation system even better. I talked about this already a little bit about the natural resource protection. We think that ag lands is critical for water storage and treatment, groundwater recharge. It's a little bit redundant. These cooperative programs that I mentioned, storing that water across the landscape, is a big, big factor of South Florida water management. We really are promoting that and documenting the benefit associated with it. And I always close this kind of presentation with this statement that Christopher Weiskel is a ethics and theology professor. I think he's currently at Yale. He wrote a paper in 1990 that I still read to this day that is just fascinating to read. Talk about agriculture and the importance of agriculture to societies. And you know, it's telling. A lot of people don't think about, but there is no such thing as a post-agricultural society. They don't make it. And there's several examples in the history record of that being the downfall of society, is when they lose their agricultural productivity.